recruit a few people and find the space and a few things of that sort. So that's...
Okay, so we need to correct, you arrived in Chicago in December of 1966.
Yes.
Not 67 as we
correct.
Thought yesterday.
Yes. Okay, let's see.
All right, well, we had gotten through much of IDAP, although I wanted to ask you specifically why you brought in Bob Schuster and what you thought you could gain from turning to more behavioral approaches at the time.
Well, it wasn't behavioral approaches. I was interested in nicotine at the time. And he had done some interesting work on nicotine. He had been one of the few people to administer IV nicotine to look at its effect on smoking. And I had developed some interest in smoking. And I thought, you know, that was my primary interest. But, you know, he had lots of other skills as well. But, you know, I thought, you know, he would be an interesting person to have. And it was the nicotine more than anything else, I think, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. And so, yes, he recalls being brought in specifically to do research on that area. Can you tell me about your interest in nicotine and when it formed and what you were thinking about it?
Well, you know, I did this chapter for Goodman and Gilman I was writing it in 1964. Because the Surgeon General's report had come out, but in the process, it was an issue of looking at all the addictive disorders in a single chapter. So I tried to get what I could on. There wasn't that much on cocaine that I could access. There was a little on cannabis, but not much. Lots on opiates, and there was stuff on alcohol, barbiturates. And the real interesting thing was that nobody was willing to see smoking as an addictive disorder. It was, in a sense, it was curious. And, you know, I was trying to understand the difficulty. Knapp and others had described, you know, a withdrawal from smoking. So there was some evidence for that. Sievers didn't agree with it. He called it, you know, a habit, not dependence. Well, even then, I didn't agree with that strange classification. And if you look into the chapter, despite my lowly status in the world, I just had to put it the way I thought. And, you know, I said that, you know, this notion is on a continuum, varies in degrees. On one extreme, you have this compulsive drug seeking, and the other, you have drug use. And there's no switch that clearly demarcates the point where you lose control over the drug. But for smoking, it did seem to me that there were people for whom this was, you know, a very compulsive disorder that met all the criteria. Now, you had to understand that I think I had seen a guy with Berger's disease who, despite having amputations, continued to smoke. If you say to somebody, you continue to do that, I'm going to cut off your arm, you'd think maybe get a little bit of behavior.
And what is Berger's disease?
It's peripheral arterial disease. Back then they would call it Berger's disease, but now they call it peripheral arterial disease. It's fairly severe. But so I had all this data, but Al Gilman, who happened to be a chain smoker, he said, "No, nicotine belongs to Murdoch Ritchie." Well, you know, it was a ganglionic blocker. It had other diseases. You know, he just couldn't buy the idea, given the context in which drug addicts were seen as dope fiends, morally depraved. I mean, this was the concept. You're either an alcoholic, you're a bum in the streets, or you're a morally compromised, depraved dope fiend. And He wasn't any of that. And the other smokers he knew weren't any of that. They couldn't be addicts. So you'll find this interesting little paragraph that says, you know, it wouldn't be surprising if in the future people begin to recognize this as a compulsive disorder. But there it sits in the chapter. And I thought, you got to do some work on this. People have to pay some attention to this. And that was published in 65, and so, you know, I'd done it, and I thought we really ought to pursue that. So that's the background.
And so what was interesting about Bob Schuster's work in that area to you?
Well, remember, in the context of you give methadone and people stop self-administering heroin, well, what happens if you give nicotine? Will they stop self-administering smoke, which contains nicotine? That's what he was doing.
Now, had you worked with Murray Jarvik? He was also working on nicotine.
Yes. Murray had already begun. Yeah, Murray was interested in smoking and cigarettes as well, had been doing things with cigarettes, had been cutting them in half and doing various things. Yeah, I was there at the time. It probably was part of the interest. I had discussed this with Murray. And he had some smoking monkeys.
Mm-hmm. Yes, so I've thought about writing an article called Teaching Monkeys to Smoke about his work on figuring out the apparatus.
Yes. There were some, we were doing things like that. And I just thought it's important because when you look at the broad dimensions of the problem, there were a lot more smokers than there were heroin addicts. Anyway, that was kind of the idea. I mean, I was interested in general principles of addiction, rather than exactly how to work on heroin addiction or this addiction or that addiction. And what was there some general theme? And so, and maybe that's kind of a curse in a way, because if you're too broad, you never really get down to the details of any one thing. But when you're asked to write something that covers all of them, it gets you involved in all of them. So,
let's talk about writing the Goodman and Gilman chapter. The first time you wrote it, How did you go about writing it? I mean, it seems like a daunting task.
Well, it was a daunting task. I didn't know any better. He asked me to write it, so I mean, I put it this way many times. In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. I had been there. I had seen addicts. I was working on things like physical dependence. He wanted people, I guess, that he knew to produce these chapters. I mean, now you realize that writing a chapter in a textbook is really not the highest level of science. It's it's a small contribution that you get junior faculty to do for the most part. Nobody ever cites the chapter. They cite Goodman and Gilman. I mean, for a long time, you wouldn't know who wrote the chapter. So, other people in the department were also tasked with writing different chapters. Now, I think he did that after I'd given a couple of lectures on the thing, but I did know something about it. I had read this stuff from Lexington, which formed a fairly large basis of a lot of what was known about addiction. So,
would you say it was the primary basis?
Not really. There is some historical material. There's other things, but I guess with respect to barbiturates and opiates, yes, that was probably the primary part of it. But the Lexington people rarely dealt with efforts at treatment. So you had to fish that out from wherever you could because nobody was doing much treatment. There were things that they didn't necessarily deal with. Larry Kolb's views of policy issues were not, he was at Lexington before there really was a Lexington, but looking at, the implications of these things, so there were things other than what was at Lexington that had to be brought in. The alcohol material, some of it was at Lexington, but others came from other areas. They had done some work on amphetamines, some work on LSD, but a lot of that came from other places as well. And they hadn't done anything on nicotine or tobacco. So everything I read on nicotine and tobacco, you know, the only thing that made its way to the chapter was one paragraph. In, at least in the first, in the 1965, the third edition. In the fourth edition, they gave me a whole column. And in the fifth edition, they let me take nicotine over. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so, yeah, I guess that, you know, there were pieces in the previous textbook that, you know, were incorporated. I mean, one of the, there was a peculiar part of writing for that textbook had to do with the technology of publishing at the time, that they had these plates. And so if you could leave a paragraph in place, just, you would actually cut and paste and leave that one there, and somehow they would keep the plate there. So, you know, it was kind of an authorized plagiarism. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Lou Goodman had written pieces of it. And if you couldn't say it any better, and there was nothing different, leave it.
So which pieces came to you, did you inherit? Did you inherit the history section?
I inherited the whole, everything in the second edition you inherited.
And then you decided what to replace.
Absolutely. So, you know, if I read something and needed to be changed, I changed it. But if it was there and it was correct, you know, the directive was, you know, leave it alone. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just, and so they had these mock-up sheets in which you take the old chapter and paste it down, and you'd have inserts, insert this, insert that, black this out, delete this, so they could, and it was, had to do, you know, as I understood it, with the way they printed things on these,
yes,
big plates.
Mm-hmm.
So there were pieces that were left from the second edition. By the fourth edition, I couldn't tell whose writing was which, but I kept changing it as things evolved. Some things never evolved. The descriptions, you know, from the, I guess there's still words from the second edition and the tenth edition.
Mm-hmm. Now, in that first round, you were already confronting the definitional problem.
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about how you came to be critical of the term addiction?
Well, I wasn't critical of the term addiction so much as recognizing that it was used in many contexts without very precise, precise operational concept of what it was. But the most important part, I thought, was that people were saying that, equating addiction with the withdrawal syndrome. You know, if you showed a withdrawal syndrome, you were hooked, you were addicted. But Whittler had shown, and the publication was there, that, you know, you could give opiates for one day, and if you gave a dose of an antagonist, back then they only had nalorphine, which was a partial agonist, so it wasn't quite precise, but you could show withdrawal. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that even by that time, California was using nalorphine as a test for opiate dependence, that if the pupil enlarged, so you could see that physical dependence began with the first dose. I don't think I was the first to say that. I think maybe Whittler was. Whittler and Fraser that wrote that paper. So if physical dependence begins with the first dose, that's not what we mean by addiction. So that everybody who's been given opiates in the hospital postoperatively would have to be defined as addiction because they had physical dependence. You could demonstrate it. The syndrome was clearly subtle. They felt achy, this and that, but it was there. So if that's the case, then physical dependence could not be what we mean by the compulsive drug-seeking behavior. Now, how do you clarify that? You clarify it by spelling out everything I just told you, mm-hmm, and say, you know, you can be addicted without being physically dependent, meaning you're locked up in a jail, you can't think of anything but getting drugs, getting using, even though you're over the withdrawal syndrome. It's largely dissipated. But the focus in life is still drug seeking. So the two, you know, are related, but they don't map on each other precisely. And what I did my best to try to convey that idea. And, you know, whether I was successful or not, I don't know. But that's, so you begin to evolve. So what do we mean when we talk about, you know, addiction? You know, and what do we mean by physical dependence? Physical dependence is easy. You know, you can make a spinal dog, you can make the lower, below the spine, you can make that addicted. It'll have physical dependence. And remember, I had just written the paper on rapid physical dependence on barbiturates. So you knew that if people were taking, you know, a certain amount of sedatives, if you had an antagonist, you could probably demonstrate early physical dependence, but they weren't addicted to barbiturates. I mean, until we had an antagonist for the benzodiazepines, which didn't take place until maybe 30 years later in the 80s, you couldn't demonstrate rapid onset of benzodiazepine physical dependence. But it was predicted that the adaptive changes that lead to this withdrawal syndrome begin very early, if not with the first dose. Anyway, that's how it came about, and that's how I wrote it.
So the other thing that struck me about the 1965 chapter is that there's no language in it yet of drugs as reinforcers. None of that language is there then.
Well,
but by the next edition, it is.
That's true. There was no language as drugs as reinforcers. I am not sure just why, and it may have been that, I don't know, because I had seen the animals, you know, self-administering the,
at the CPDD meeting in 1962,
yeah.
You had seen that, but the language, could it have been that the language was not yet fully formed? People were using conditioning kind
well,
of language.
I think conditioning was there, but
behavioral.
Not, yeah, but not the reinforcers. I haven't read that, what's a 40-year-old chapter now?
Yeah.
Haven't read it in a while, so I don't
it
know.
Took us some digging to dig it up, actually.
Well, it's right here in the textbook.
Yeah.
No, I really don't recall whether we, you know, if I didn't use it, I didn't use it. But I mean, one of the difficulties of writing chapters is you're given a very, very rigid page allotment. And so I tried to be as economical as I could, and it still came in 20% over. And that usually is, you know, results in lightning bolts coming down from Lou Goodman and Gilman, and they're furious and everything. And Lou Goodman, you know, Gilman called me into his office and told me what Lou Goodman said. He said, "We can't cut this. Put it all in extract type."
So that's why the type size differences.
Yes. They kept to the pages, but they had to put it in small print because they couldn't find anything that wasn't worth saying.
That was very flattering for an assistant professor.
It was. I mean, you could say change my life. I mean, it's these are the giants saying that. So anyway, I don't recall whether I said anything about drugs as reinforcers, but clearly I think Wickler's notion of drugs reinforcing the behavior was, you know, somewhere in there.
Mm-hmm.
I know we talked about it. I know we talked a little bit about conditioning. And I think we talked about sociologic factors and other factors and pharmacological factors, and I'd be surprised if I didn't say that the drugs produced reinforcement. I'll get the book if you like.
Yeah, no, I think that it's there, but it's not as... The next edition
it's used in headings. It's sort of more organizationally present.
Well,
and so I was interested in not so much literal were the words there, but was there a change in the way you were thinking about the field and that the field itself was
moving? No, I think there could have been a little bit of both. But I think the more important, and who knows, you know, what influences you had in pinching on you, you know, 40 or 35 years ago. I think by that time, I was already at in Illinois, and maybe there could have been something. But the other thing, in terms of organizational issues, is, you know, I was writing these chapters as I was doing the research, and a tremendous amount of work going into it, and it's hard for people to understand this, but back in those days, you might have to have this type letter perfect. Mm-hmm. Several times we were working with carbon paper. I mean, so much went into the mechanics of getting it right, you know, and the references had to be exactly this way. I mean, they had their own rigid kinds of things. That it may be that you just didn't have time to reflect on how you could improve the organization. I mean, first of all, it was an organizational effort to take all those disparate pieces and put them into the organizational effort there was, there is a common phenomenon called drug use, drug dependence. And these are the common factors. Mm-hmm. To pull those out of all the different things, instead of opiate addiction, this, and so. And that was the first step. And the next was, you know, I think clinical something. We actually described the separate syndromes. Mm-hmm. And then you have miscellaneous drugs. If you have a few years and some time when it came back, you could reflect on it some more. Mm-hmm. But I don't really remember precisely, you know, how the things evolved.
There was also an interesting issue of time in terms of the lexicon, because drug dependence, there was still, you know, there was an attempt even at the level of the World Health Organization, right, to change to the language of drug dependence, and your piece kind of got caught in.
Well, they were changing. I was basically writing against their 1964 criteria for a publication to come out in 1965. Mm-hmm. And in 1965 they switched, and they themselves, you know, the mighty Mo Sievers and Eddie and all those guys, recognized the shortcomings of habituation versus addiction, and they changed.
To drug dependence.
To drug dependence, which is fine. And I'm not sure to what degree they changed it in time for me, for that chapter to change, because the chapter is fully submitted a full year before. You wrote a book, you know how long it takes for the manuscript to move from manuscript through galleys into...
Still a year.
Well, back then, I'm sure it could have been even. So there's tight deadlines. So, you know, a year before, the experts at WHO decided that they had come up with a categorization, a way of thinking about it. I had said, you know, I can't live with what they have, because I don't think it makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And so that's how the introductory part evolved.
Yeah.
And, well, it was okay.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to ask you was, do you think that you seem to have had a very early and almost personal interest in narcotic antagonists? I mean, you saw use potential in them in a very clear sort of way, and you wrote about that as well.
Well, this was 64, and I think that the first stuff on cyclazine and Wickler talking about it and things of this sort suggested, yeah, it, you know, this was a reasonable there's a reasonable concept that if you could block the reinforcing effect, so the notion of reinforcement was there. If I didn't use it, it was inherent in what I was saying. You could use the antagonist, block the reinforcement, eventually you would extinguish all of this, and it was a reasonable theory. Mm-hmm. And maybe by 64, wait a second, I was writing this in 64, my God. 64, in addition to doing the research and teaching in pharmacology, I was taking a residency in psychiatry with NyQuil.
Yes.
So it may very well be that that had some impact on how much reflection I could do on.
You mean on the sleep chapter. Deprivation?
I imagine that contributed somewhat as well. But I was already interested in, I may have already started on the cyclazazine project, I don't know. Exactly when that came about, because I knew about, I think Bill Martin presented the theory of cyclazine as a blocker, maybe at a CPDD meeting, and it might have been 64 that I heard it before the chapter was in. I just don't recall when that was done. But yeah, I mean, if you have a tool, you know, maybe you could test this out.
When did you first start working with WHO and meet Griffith Edwards?
I met Griffith Edwards in 1969.
Okay.
He says he came to visit me in Chicago. I don't really remember that very well, but we did meet in the summer. We worked together at his house in the summer of 1970, and we put down, we developed a paper for, a working paper for WHO. And that's when we began.
And he had read your Goodman and Gilman chapter? Or
he might have. I mean, I'm not sure I asked him to read my Goodman and Gilman chapter. But, you know, we were just working together. He had already set up this addiction research center at the Maudsley, and he had already had a year or so before, had a kind of a conference there on national strategies and things of that sort. And so this was a working paper on policy issues for WHO.
All right, so to finish out IDAP, is there anybody else there? I guess I'd like to hear something about your Ed Sine and your work with him.
Well, Ed was the head of consultation liaison. And he sort of got interested and asked if he could play a role. And, you know, again, there was this odd conflict that, sure you can, but I just can't say, here, take some salary. I mean, I had to be accountable to the state. Even on the grants, you couldn't just say, you're my friend, why don't you take some of your salary from the grant? Don't have to do anything. And we had to talk about what role you would take. And, you know, that was... I mean, I don't know what role we carved out, but I could certainly use all the help we could get. This was fairly early. I don't think we got the grant until late in 1968, and we had already been up and running since the beginning of 68 with the state money. So we had this administrative problem of blending the two and who would do what, where. Got very interested, and he eventually switched over and became completely interested in drug addiction and gave up the consultation of the AMA. Mm-hmm.
And I also want to, in Michael Massing's book, he talks about Patrick Hughes and you having conflict over outreach slots. Can you explain that?
Sure. Pat wanted to have all of the new openings as people came in assigned to him so he could use them as incentives when he was going out to do work, his epidemiological work. Oh, do this for me, talk to me, and I'll get you right into the program. I said, Pat, you can't do that. There are lots of people who want to come in. They're not in your neighborhoods, and we can do some of that. We can't do all of it.
I see. I didn't figure that out at all.
If you were going out to interview people, what do they have to offer them? Can they get them right in? Well, you know, there's a limit to what you can do there, because everybody wanted to get this brother-in-law and everybody else on. And to a certain extent, you want to, it's like, you know, a kind of a commodity that is scarce. And it was bad enough because you'd have people at the various clinics putting their friends before somebody else. I mean, having a waiting list that you knew, you know, could mean the difference between being arrested, not being arrested, overdose, not overdose. Very hard to keep it orderly and fair. And to start at the top and say, well, this is not fair, we're going to basically make your entry into the program contingent upon your cooperating with somebody's research. Seemed to me we could do a little of that. The research was important. But it couldn't preempt everything.
I see. That's actually very important clarification. So, the ending of your relationship with IDAP, how did that happen?
I got drafted.
Can you tell me about that?
Well, I guess it was the same summer of 1970. We'd come back from WHO. We had the, Griffith and I presented the paper. The committee took all the, what we thought was beautifully crafted language.
And this was the paper on national strategy?
On strategies, yes. So, and chopped it into bureaucratic junk. But it was okay, that's what committees do. And I got a visit from Jeff Donfeld. Jeff Donfeld, I didn't know him. He said he worked for Abel Krogh, who worked for John Ehrlichman. And I didn't know who they were either. And they said they worked at the White House. I said, it's fine. So he wanted to, Bob DuPont had sent them, he should see the program. Fine. So I showed him around the program and we talked a little bit. And I think sometime, not long thereafter, it could have been, well, maybe it was July, someplace I have a letter around. The FDA, under the influence of both, I guess, Justice and DEA and NIMH, was trying to sort of put an end to the proliferation of methadone programs. And they wrote a set of guidelines for getting INDs and who could be admitted and this and that. And they were rather, they were very, very restrictive. And I think Jeff called me and said, you know, look at what they're proposing, you know, what's your response? And I wrote a 3 or 4 page letter. Don't know whether I sent it to him or sent it to the FDA or whatever, but...
Do you know who in the FDA was...
I think Edwards was the head of the FDA at the time, but I don't know who would have gotten it. Anyway, so this is still the summer of 70, as I recall. Maybe it was September of 70. And then, you know, and again, I would have to go back to papers and things to try to figure out what was going on. But then Jeff called and said he'd like me to form a committee to write some kind of position paper or white paper on what the federal government should do about treatment. And he started laying down these various constraints. First of all, you have to recruit people. They would have to meet, consider all the data, get it all written, and have it in by December the 1st or something like that. And it would have to be secret. And if anybody knew you were doing it, it would be useless to the White House. And it couldn't be published. Sort of a secret document. Well, I understood it later that, you know, if you want to put forth a position, and it leaks out, and anything good in it will be sort of claimed by the other side. Look what we thought of. And isn't it nice that the president is finally doing what we said he should do? If there's something they don't like in it, they'll rev up things and criticize it before you even have a chance to explain it. So I got the idea. And this was a difficult time. You have to understand this was sort of almost the peak of the Vietnam kind of protests and things of this sort. We're talking about 1970. I mean, riots hadn't been that far into the past. So I found some people who would be willing to do that. Some people said, if I can't publish it, I'm not interested. And they refused to participate. Some people said, well, I'm writing a book myself, and I can't assure you that some of the things you say I wouldn't put in my book. I mean, there are various reasons that people didn't want to do this. First of all, it didn't pay much, and it was secret, and it was for the Nixon White House. I mean, there was a limited number of people, but I got some people to agree to do this, and we wrote that report.
Was there anything... It appeared to me that there were a lot of psychopharmacologists who were on that panel.
There were people who knew something about drugs. I mean, some were psychopharmacologists, some were psychiatrists. As I recall, there was a sociologist, a criminologist. I'm trying to remember all the people that were on it. Somebody who knew something about alcoholism. There were 10 people.
So Jonathan Cole.
Jonathan Cole.
And Jack Mendelsohn.
Jack Mendelsohn. I can't remember if Helen Nolis was on it or not.
Yeah, I think she was.
There's a guy named Roger Smith who was a criminologist. I can get the thing and give you all the names. And nobody ever leaked it. Roger Meyer would have been terrific, but he was busy writing his own book.
You were trying to kind of get some representation across the disciplines, or didn't that really matter?
Sure,
so it did.
Well, I mean, Helen Nolis knew about prevention and school programs. Roger Smith was a criminologist. Jonathan Cole knew about psychopharmacology and certainly knew about the organization of NIMH and what it could do. Jack Mendelsohn knew about that. He knew about alcoholism.
Now, at the time, did you know that NIMH was also being asked to submit a report?
I am not sure that I knew that they were writing this in-house report concurrently until sometime later. Ed Brecker clearly... Did Ed Brecker, had he come out with his book yet? The answer is no.
Oh, I thought it had come out.
No, his book came out in 1972.
Yeah.
I don't know where I got Ed Brecker, where I got his name. Maybe I saw it someplace, but I asked him to help me write it. He agreed. Let's see. God, why can't I remember all the other names? Bill McLaughlin, was he on that?
That I don't know.
I'll have to go look. I will have to go look. But, you know, I went through people I thought had some knowledge. I think Jack O'Donnell might have been on it.
Yeah.
He's a sociologist. He was from Lexington. He knew outcome studies. If you want to look at, you know, the people that were on that, they're people of some stature. I was very, very fortunate to be able to recruit. There might have been one or two others, but I can't really recall. And they had to be willing to come on weekends and
work. What was the process like?
Well, the process was... God, I don't remember the process. I really don't.
Maybe you fake the will.
No,
they came to you? They came to Chicago?
We met at different places. It wouldn't be fair for them to all fly to Chicago. But we flew to different places, and eventually Ed Brecker and I just sat down and took all the transcripts and tried to put it together, and then they looked at it, things of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be short enough so people could read it. and it had to be punchy enough, and it was going to be read by anybody. You know, it was supposed to.
So was it ever, did it ever become available?
To whom?
To anyone. Other, I mean, did it remain?
I never published it.
Secret.
It didn't remain secret. But I mean, it was available. Nobody ever made anything of it.
Mm-hmm. And what did you, what do you say, what were your take-home messages in that document?
Well, the take-home messages were that there are different drug problems. We have a problem with drug, with youth using, you know, psychedelics and marijuana. We have a problem with heroin. And that, you know, here's how, basically, we were told by Jeff, look, if the president was willing to put, you know, $100 million into the treatment area, treatment prevention research area, you know, what should we do? I mean, it was that kind of thing. Okay, you're smart, you guys, tell us how you would do it. And our big bitch, I mean, first of all, was a complaint that nobody should be asked to try to make policy in this way in 6 weeks without all the data, without thoroughly understanding what was going on by all the different agencies. I mean, what we found out was there are too damn many agencies. All of them had 5 or 10 million here or 20 million there, and no coordination at all. There was no mechanism that said OEO ought to talk to the volunteers. I mean, there were different groups. You know, there was there was 18 different agencies, all of whom giving out money, often at cross purposes, or sometimes to the same people for the same purpose. There was no effort to find out how effective are your programs. What are you accomplishing? So we said, basically, this should not happen. There should be some kind of cohesive way to look across everything you're doing, to evaluate it, to understand what works, what doesn't work. And you should ask people like us to do this way. You know, we felt put upon. Mm-hmm. Having said that, we said, here's what we think you want to do. First of all, you need more research. I mean, you don't have the necessary data to make sensible policy. The preliminary was actually not fully plagiarized, since I guess I had written part of it, but it was paraphrased from the stuff that Griffith and I produced for the WHO. That talked about a national strategy.
Mm-hmm. And the WHO had come to Griffith, and then he had come to you.
No, it was Dale Cameron.
Yes.
Dale Cameron. Uh-huh. And I don't know why he put me with Griffith. I mean, it's like, you know, I guess you could get, you know, some pygmy to help Shaquille O'Neal. I mean, that's how I felt about it, but, you know, I'll toss him the ball, he'll put it in. No. I mean, Griffith could have done this completely by himself. I mean, he has that perspective, and he's that articulate. Mm-hmm. I mean, even his letters read like literature.
Yes.
So.
Yes. So interestingly, for the WHO document, it was really you and Griffith Edwards. And then for this, it was this... You were supposed to coordinate this whole committee. You were supposed to craft a group statement.
Yes.
And the interpretation of that report, do you agree? Apparently, Bud Krogh told Michael Massing that the report added up to the interpretation that methadone maintenance was the only effective technique available. Would you agree that that's what that report, did that report mention methadone? As you
remember, what was the
status of methadone in that?
No, what happened was, as we were writing it, Jeff was looking at what the other group was doing, and they were really anti-methadone maintenance.
Yes.
Raising all the objections to it, the wrong signal, and the minorities don't like it, and it goes on and on. And so he kept saying, answer this criticism, answer that criticism.
To you.
So, yes.
To you. he would say.
To me, at Brecker, I said, look, okay, you know, if somebody's raising that, I guess we have to do it. So it got longer in terms of preempting or at least responding to criticisms that he told us were being made.
Right. And did he tell you who was making them?
I'm not sure he told us who was making them, but, you know, you get the idea that other people in the bureaucracy were making those, or he was hearing those, and those things had to be dealt with. Now, we thought methadone would be useful and needed to be there.
But it was not the main point.
Well, the main points were you need to have data to make policy. The main points were you ought to have a coordinated strategy. You shouldn't be doing these things in 6 weeks. You ought to have some coordination about all the money you're spending over all these agencies. Somebody ought to know what's going on. There is no mechanism. Except at OMB, somebody up there might know, but only the guy at the top of OMB would know where all that money was going. And there was considerable amounts. And nobody, for sure, even that guy, knew what impact you were having. So that's one. Number two is, you want to have a plan. You know, think it through. What is it that you want to achieve? How do you want to achieve it? Number three, you need data to know whether your strategy. We talked about you ought to have some kind of strategy. You ought to know what you're doing. And you ought to have data to say whether your plan is working. You ought to be looking, you know, it led to things like Dawn and national surveys. You ought to know. You can't know whether your policy is effective unless you say, this is how we'll know. Mm-hmm. And lastly, there's just not enough money in research in this area. Actually, it turned out there's a lot less in it than they thought they had in it, because some of it was being typical ways in bureaucracy. Oh, you want a blue suit? Turn on the blue light, you know. All the work that, you know, everything that everybody was doing was relevant to AIDS when the AIDS money came down.
Mm-hmm. Yes, suddenly.
Suddenly.
Yes, yeah. So...
Anyway, so...
When did you completed that document in time for the deadline?
Well, actually, no. He gave us an extra 2 weeks. Went in December the 15th.
And at what point did you realize that there was an NIMH? There was a sort of competing document?
I'm not sure. Might have been months later. Mm-hmm.
And so, your committee, you would not say that methadone maintenance was the main. I mean, you've given me a bunch of points that came out of that document.
Would you like to see the document?
I'd love to see the document.
I'll give you a copy.
That'd be lovely. Wonderful.
You can judge for yourself.
Now, what I'm trying to do right now is just sort of concatenate among different people's interpretations of what was kind of going on at that time and figure out what your sense of it was. So did you mention the multimodality approach in that document? Was that...
I may not have mentioned it directly, but we said that there are more than one kind of treatment that you might have to have. Remember, opiate dependence was not the only problem you were dealing with. There were multiple drug abuse problems. Methadone could only deal with heroin addiction. What do you do about barbiturate addiction and amphetamine addiction and other kinds of things? You know, kids using LSD couldn't use methadone. I mean, there was cannabis use, there was all this stuff. You had to, you know, there ought to be some support for therapeutic communities. I mean, you know, another Tinley Park someplace, maybe. I don't
know. Right.
But it's clear that, you know, that this is not the only problem, and you need to look at that. So did that imply multimodality? Well, it would have been ideal to have less rivalry and bickering and more, how do we focus on the populations that need help? Now, I haven't read that thing in many, many years, so, you know, you can glance through it and see what you conclude. But, so... No, in no way did it suggest that that was the only thing. If there was any emphasis on it, it came because there was so much counter propaganda or counter-argument why it should not be expanded. So Donfeld wanted to say, unless we do this, you won't have any of it. It's a tool that we think, because he was looking at DuPont's program, which were predominantly methadone in D.C., reducing crime, and said, well, this is effective. We don't have much data on the efficacy of the other things. So if we want to have impact, we ought to use what we have. And these guys want to cut it off.
Right. So now, as I recall, you did not know, the committee was not aware at the time, that there was a problem with heroin addiction among GIs.
No, not at all.
So there was no mention of that.
It was absolutely, it was a big surprise. The military never, the question of drug use in the military was not even on the horizon.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I, as I also recall, you were pretty, you got a little note from Nixon thanking you.
Yeah, I happened to tour someplace.
A relatively anticlimactic response.
Yeah, I'm sure somebody wrote it for me, signed it. Or maybe the auto pen signed it, I never knew.
So you went back to doing what you were doing.
Sure. I never stopped doing what I was doing.
And
I mean, nobody said, take some time off from the Illinois Drug Abuse Program and drop everything and do this. And this was still a growing program that was very busy and expanding.
Yeah. All right. So so then what happened next? When did you again hear from the White House?
I didn't hear from them again until, I guess it must have been April, right after Murphy and Steele began talking about Vietnam.
And so how did you learn about that?
They called me. The White House.
And you did not know about it before that?
No.
You got it, the news in the call?
Yeah. I don't know whether they first told the White House what they were going to say, or they announced it, but I know that they called me and said, you know, we'd like to consult with you, and I asked me to fly in and talk about it.
Was that again Jeff Donfeld?
Yeah, he was the point guy. I mean, Krogh had many, many responsibilities. Ehrlichman had the whole domestic agenda, mm-hmm. from environment and all, you name it. If it wasn't on the, that was it. And Krogh was drugs and crime and maybe a few other things. So that was Justice Department, Washington, D.C., name all that. And Jeff was his assistant on drugs. So it, that was the pathway.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so apparently, you know, they had been trying to get information about drugs for some time from the military and kept getting reassurance that it's under control. And then this thing fell on them. Yeah, I probably got it from Jeff. I don't, if you could talk to Jeff, he'll remember.
Mm-hmm.
He's perfectly lucid and available and probably has a better memory than I do.
Then tell me, so when did the trip, how soon after that call did you end up going to Vietnam?
I didn't know I was going to Vietnam. The first thing that happened was that they called me and said, you know, we'd like your views on what to do. But you can't tell anybody. I mean, you have to understand that this obsession with secrecy mm-hmm. continued.
Mm-hmm.
So now how do you come up with a solution when you can't get any consultation? You know, I believed if the White House said you can't talk about it, that you shouldn't talk about it. And what I was fairly certain about, maybe not entirely certain, was that when they said 15% to 20% were addicted, that they didn't have a clear notion of what they really meant by addicted. It could be that they were 15% to 20% that were addicted. It could be that this was the usual hype, or it could be that they had a lot of people using, some of whom were addicted. So there were a lot of questions, and it wasn't clear what to do, but it was clear that there was a considerable amount of panic of what happens when you send addicted people trained, you know, in military tactics, and you put them on the plane, and you know, 18 hours later, you leave them off, and they're free in the community. It, you know, given people's perceptions of what a heroin addict was, which hadn't changed very much because there wasn't much treatment, people still viewed this as, you know, people who's had less than human instincts. There were people proposing, you know, civil commitment and confinement, and I mean, the draconian kinds of things they were talking about, were, you know, came out of a sense of panic. Mm-hmm. People talking about one addict makes 10 addicts, and yes, all kinds. First thing you need to do is, how big is this problem? And given the code of military justice, where if you're found to be a heroin user, you can have a bad conduct or a dishonorable discharge, don't expect too much in the way of honest response. Now, one way to find out who's using is you do urine tests. But, you know, this was again, I guess it was 1971 now. One thing that, you know, seemed like a possibility was that there were some people who were using, who would not use, if their use were more visible. One of the things that people said was, if you smoke marijuana, everybody knows you're smoking it because they can smell it, but nobody can tell you're using heroin. Well, suppose you could tell. Then you have a small deterrent. And so what I proposed is, we need to have epidemiological data, and you need to have some deterrent that says, you probably should stop before you go home. And so we said, the thing to do is to test everybody before they leave. And that was a simple idea. That'll tell you how many people are using. Pretty soon people get the idea that, you know, you don't leave as readily. I mean, they wouldn't, if I find them using, I'm going to immediately ship them home. I said, you know, then you're going to have 100% use.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was arguing with General, you know,
that's not logical.
You do not want to do that.
It's like Henry Beecher and, you know, his old studies, you know, during World War II, where people who did not need painkillers because they knew that they were going to get off the battlefield. It's very conditional, you know.
Yes.
Very.
I said, you do not want to do that. No. What you want to do is to say, if you're positive, you stay a little longer. You know, those pop things, they're gunfire. It's gunfire. You stay. And, you know, they were talking about putting them on a slow boat, all kinds of things in it. You stay. We'll detox people there. And I'm arguing with generals and things of this sort. I don't know much about the military, but, you know, I have some idea of, you know, behavior, things of this sort. So, this was my idea. So they asked me to present my idea to Ehrlichman. I present to Ehrlichman. And then, I think the sequence was that Jeff and I went over to talk to the people at the Pentagon. He said, let's go with this. I mean, it's a strange thing, you know, is in Washington, this theme, you can't beat something with nothing. It may not have been the best idea, but they didn't have a better one. Now, the trick is, how do you test 1,000 people in a day? It is not technologically, thin layer wouldn't have. I mean, thin layer takes skill, interpreting. There's a certain art to getting it right and looking at it, things of this sort. But I had this frat machine that I had the only one that I had put on order for the Illinois Drug Abuse Program. I knew we had that, and that it could, you know, a little bit of urine, you could get the answer in a minute. It would screen for opiates. I mean, later on they figured out how to screen for everything, but right then they could screen for opiates. And, you know, sometime before we went to the Pentagon, knowing that we might do this, I asked a guy named Bill McLaughlin, who was vice president of Cyber Corporation, that was making these things, you know, how long it would take him to make another one. Since I think I was his first customer for this $25,000 machine. It was quite a lot of money. You know, I said, look, I can't tell you exactly why I'm saying this, but could you take a risk and put some people on this? He said, it'd take me several weeks, a month or two. I said, how about if you work double shifts? Yeah. Excuse me. I seem to have picked up a cold. Anyway, make a long story shorter, he said he would do that. We now had two machines. I would give up the one from Illinois, he would produce another one. And then we went to the Pentagon, Jeff and I, and they said, well, this can't be done. Besides, we were thinking of doing it ourselves. I mean, it was really bizarre. And it can't be done. We were thinking of doing it ourselves, and maybe we can do it in September. Well, this was May the 30th, and 1,000 people were leaving every day. And, I mean, this story is well known. It was like dumb kid saying to all these generals, I said, you know, I can't believe that the greatest army in the world can't get its troops to piss in a bottle. Secretary of the Army is sitting. I said, look, I know you're busy with a war. How you got other things to do? But if you get me a telephone, I'll call some civilians, and if you'll give us some transportation, we'll set this thing. Because I said, I think the president really wants something done sooner. Now, he just fired Wally, whatever his name was, the Secretary of Energy from, he was from Alaska. I can't remember his name. Pack up, we want you out by Friday. I mean, Nixon was known as somebody who, you know, out. So they called a recess right in the middle of this thing. They went over in the other room. And they came back and said, okay, June the 17th, we'll have it up and running. I said, sounds good to me. You know, we talked, I had this machine, they had this machine. Well, they didn't really trust the machine, so they had a, you know, a bank of gas chromatographs to verify it. They just, I mean, maybe it would have false positives. Remember, once it screened negative, they didn't bother, but if it was positive, they screened for it. So in other words, if somebody got through the frat, he was home free, even if it was positive. So I don't know how sensitive they made it. But, the problem, of course, that I didn't realize was that the electricity is not that good in Vietnam. And you have to have steady currents and things of this sort to work gas chromatographs and the frat machine. And then you have to build places where you can detox people and do it. It's not a trivial undertaking. And it was beyond belief that they were able to do that in a matter of a little over 2 weeks.
But so at what point did you go?
Well, I wasn't expecting to go. So on the 7th...
So they agreed that they were going to do this.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they were going
to
do it.
You were the consultant, and you were going to go back to Chicago. And
that was my plan. You wanted my opinion? I said what to do. They're going to do it. Fine, I'll lend them my machine. That was it. So basically, you know, they got Bill McLaughlin, and they handcuffed him to one of the machines, and because they were going to unload it in Guam. And he said, no, we go. They took the guy right from the who knew how to put it together, and they took him to Vietnam and got the thing set up. It's quite an undertaking. So, you know, that was all set up and it looked like it was pretty much ready to go. In the meantime, I guess, you know, Krogh and Donfeld and other people were talking about, now how do we announce what we're going to do? You know, what do? What's our big thrust? And, you know, they came up, I guess they took a couple of the ideas that there ought to be some coordinating mechanism. Somebody ought to have some oversight about what's working, what's not working, and planning. And they came up with this idea of a special action office in the White House to oversee the whole thing. And, you know, I thought, gee, you know, I wasn't really sure, I guess until maybe a day or two before, you know, what they were really doing. I mean, they didn't tell me about most of this stuff. But, you know, I was in the cabinet room. I told Krogh, you know, I think he said something like, well, you know, what would you be willing to do? I said, you know, would you be willing to help somebody here? He said, look, I don't want to be somebody's assistant here. Now, they took that to mean, like, I don't want to be vice president if I can't run the whole thing. But what I really meant was I just didn't want a job. I had a job. I didn't want that job. And I guess they took that to mean, no, if I can't run the whole thing, I don't want it. It's not what I meant at all. I just didn't want to be second fiddle to some politician. So, you know, Krogh says this is called appointment by ambush. That was his term. You know, actually, you've seen that, I guess, on the West Wing. Did you ever watch the West Wing?
Oh, I loved the West Wing.
Well, how somehow they get somebody, they announce that he's accepted.
Right.
Well, there I was sitting in the cabinet room when he was president. This was something, it might have been the 17th even. Could have been the 16th, the 17th. It's around someplace. I wasn't expecting to even stay over. I came on the 16th. I wasn't expecting to stay over. They said, you have to stay over. We need you. I said, somebody went out and bought me a shirt that was too big. Crazy stuff. And I was in the cabinet room. And he had the congressional leadership, and he announced his big thrust. And he said, and that man over there, Dr. Jaffe, is going to run it. Now, at that age, you don't say, Mr. President, who the hell told you that? I mean, it was a cut in salary, moving my family, what I do with my house in Chicago. I mean, they don't pay for transportation at that level, position. That's all on your own. I mean, there's a certain issue of, at the cabinet level, I mean, if you're a civil servant, when I was in the public health service, and they moved me from Staten Island, where I was an intern, to Lexington, they paid for the move. This thing had to pay for your own move, everything else, because the prestige. So I took about a 50% cut in salary. I had to pay for my own move, find all my own.
And how did you really feel about working for the Nixon administration? I mean, as a political person.
Well, you know, it's very hard to say. Clearly, there were lots of people who were virulently anti-Nixon. I was not among them because, you know, I was not, you know, I knew that he'd been on the House Un-American Activity stuff, and there were lots of liberals that sort of hated him as sort of the representation. I mean, there were people who were defending Alger Hiss that I was seeing and continued to do so, but I was not that involved in things, and I knew that, you know, there was corruption on all sides of things. I mean, I lived in Chicago with Mayor Daley, and I was working for a Republican governor because by the time, you know, the Illinois drug program had turned over and Governor Ogilvie had taken over, and he was a very nice man. He was a Republican. I guess that's why Nixon thought I was acceptable, because Ogilvie liked me. He liked me because I wasn't asking for huge amounts of money and I was making programs go. Anyway, how did I feel about it? I guess I felt that you only had one president at a time. and he's the president, and what he's doing makes good sense. I mean, what I felt was, my God, this is the first time we've really had a bite at the apple in something other than, you know, strict law enforcement. And everything he's doing is exactly what we wanted to do. We're really going to make treatment happen.
And what about the war?
What about it?
How would you felt about Vietnam?
Well, I felt it should have not have happened. But I didn't see that letting everybody come home addicted would necessarily improve things. I was not, I guess I was not detached from it. And I certainly think that, you know, it was probably something we shouldn't have gotten into, but it's hard to say exactly what I thought about it at the time. It's hard if you're really not... What I know is if you really don't know all the data, it's hard to interpret what people are saying. Is there really a domino effect? You know, if you simply pull out, do you really have communist control of Cambodia and Laos and Thailand? And what is that? What is the impact of that? And I recognize that there are certain areas where the average person knows only what he's told from the newspapers and reporters and things. And I don't know. Was it spin? Was it not spin? What I knew is that, you know, you had a lot of decent Americans, you know, carrying out what they were told was their duty. And that, you know, if I could be of help with this problem, that would be fine, but I couldn't control the other things. What I was concerned about was this, and now that I recall this, what I was concerned about is the Vietnamese are not stupid. If they thought that 25% of the Americans were in heroin, what does that do to their planning with respect to how successful they could be? What does that do to their plans for attacking Americans? To, you know, how does that change the equation? And that, now, if you think that everybody is stoned or drunk and you're an opposing side, you have a very different view of what you can do than if you think they're all ready and they're alert and they have firepower and everything else. And so I thought that that puts a lot of people at risk in ways that I couldn't really, you know, work out. But I just thought that in putting some of this stuff into place, we can get a better perspective on it and bring it under control. I thought it would make the guys who were over there safer, mm-hmm. simply because people would not have that perception.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of safety, I've always had this question about Vietnam. Was there an overdose? Death
yes,
problem
there were,
in
there,
Vietnam?
Yes, there were overdose deaths.
And was that... I don't recall ever running into discussion of that. Was that part of the discussion?
There was data to that effect, and that was one of the things that was alerting people like Krogh to the fact that the military wasn't giving them the whole story that everything's under control.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they were a little annoyed that they had been continually reassured that it's all under control. But for that, you got to talk to Krogh, because, you know, he had visited there, he had done things, he had made several visits there. Anyway, so I got drafted on the 17th, and they rolled me out to say, I mean, I was totally unprepared to meet the press and everything else, and, you know, couldn't believe that they were shoving me out in front of the White House press corps with zero preparation for what to say and things of this sort.
You could have said anything.
I could have. I mean,
At what point did Faith know at that point?
You can ask her. No, most of it came as a surprise.
Surprise.
Yes. It came as most, pretty much of a surprise to me. The people at the University of Chicago were furious that I hadn't given them a heads up. But how can I give them a heads up? First of all, I didn't want it.
Oh, yes.
And number two, I didn't know it was coming.
Yes. And that, your relationship with Danny Friedman.
Well, my relationship with Danny Friedman had to do with the fact that chairman, there were several. One, chairmen are under great pressure to bring in grants. That's what medical schools are about, grants and overhead. And, you know, he saw this big grant that I had. $800,000 to run this program. I had this other money from the state. And he didn't see why, you know, I wasn't willing to share it. And have people, and I said, well, you know, he would propose so-and-so would work on the program. I said, well, what would he do? He said, oh, there's no quid pro quo. That was his words.
Yes, it's sort of the days before deliverables were running everybody's life in a way. He thought there was more play than
well, but
there was.
Whether there is play or not, the issue is if you put ghosts on your payroll, I mean, what difference is it if I put his favorite professor on my payroll who doesn't do anything, or if I put my wife? Is there some kind of ethical difference? Is there some kind of legal difference? I mean, I wasn't, you know, this was, I mean, it was Chicago, but you just didn't put people in the no-show jobs. This was... This was wasn't the New Jersey waterfront.
Right. So this had been a historical issue between you and him.
Well, it grew as the other grant came up and things of this sort. Yes. You know, how was his department benefiting from this? Now, it might have been that he also wanted to be authors on that all paper. Some chairmen do. But then he should have said so. I'd have been happy. You want to be an author? Put your name on it. Huh? So no... Wouldn't have bothered me at that time. That, you know, there wasn't this sharp thing that you shouldn't do that. I mean, lots of places still do that, that the senior person, no matter how little they contribute, is always an author on the paper. That level of ethics hadn't really emerged. So as long as he was looked over the paper, read it, knew about it, participated, that's fine. He never said that, though. So that could have been another issue. But I think the major thing had to do with issues of resources and how the department could benefit, but at the same time, I had this tremendous conflict that I told you about. I was simultaneously the head of a grant at the university and the head of a state program. And you know, how do you make sure that everybody is getting an honest count? And you know, so I think that was a lot of it.
So your new job.
I just had to resign from everything, and that Danny put Anson A. in charge of the grant on NIH, and I'm sure that maybe things were more accommodative after that.
And you quickly moved to D.C.
Well, yeah. Nobody said come in a month, come in 2 months.
Right.
I mean, it began that day. And I think I was told on something like, maybe I was even told that day, in addition to being headed, I was going to go to Vietnam.
Yes, I was going to ask you then how quickly that followed.
The plan to go, you know, I think might have been announced fairly quickly, but I don't think I went until the end of July, the end of June. There's this book that, I don't know if you've seen it, called Heroes and Heroine. Have you seen
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I have that book. I have that book at home.
Well, they arranged to have these people from ABC record everything.
Yeah. So they were along the whole way.
I guess. Huh. You know, it was...
It's interesting. I found that it's an old paperback book that I found in a used bookstore.
I don't think I have a copy here. I was looking at it for purposes...
You don't have the TV show, do you? I'm sure that you don't have the TV show. They did make a television show.
That too. No, I don't think so. Well, anyway, it's around someplace.
So ABC tagged along the whole trip.
I wasn't paying much attention to what they were doing, Frank. You know, I was pretty much overwhelmed by what the responsibilities that had been shoved at me, which were innumerable.
And how did you pick? You picked Benny Prim. You chose some people to go along with you.
Yeah. And I had known Benny. We had met. I just thought Benny, first of all, Benny had been in the military. He had been, you know, airborne. I didn't think he went to combat because he got injured in one of his jumps, but he knew something about the military. And he knew about addiction. And I thought he could relate to a lot of the African-American troops better than I could. And we brought a couple of people with us.
Who else went along?
Seth Rosenberg went. He had to do with, you know, NIMH. He was public relations or whatever he was. I don't know why he went. I mean, I'm not sure that other than picking...